Hello, welcome to NELLAB Spotlight. My name is Lena Bilkkanen, and today I'm going to talk to Ryan Law about our recent paper on the neural processing of lists with and without syntax. So this paper just came out in the Journal of Neuroscience, and Ryan was a research assistant in the Abu Dhabi branch of our lab. Our lab has a site both in New York and in Abu Dhabi, and he just recently finished an RA-ship in Abu Dhabi. So in this study, people are reading lists of words. So for example, pianos, violins, guitars. And in one case, that little list is embedded inside a longer list. So you might have something like theater, graves, drums, mulch, pianos, violins, guitars, crates, knuckle, cocotte, so forth. But then in the other critical condition, that same list is actually inside a sentence. So we can put, obviously, a list inside a sentence. So for example, the music store sells pianos, violins, guitars, drums, and clarinets. And so here, what we're interested in is comparing the neural activity to those list items as they're just members of a longer list versus a situation in which they're actually inside that sentential structure. And the reason why this contrast is interesting is because we're looking at the fact of the syntactic tree. So in one case, the list is inside the syntactic tree. And we're keeping the actual lexical items completely constant. And furthermore, in neither case are those lexical items, so pianos, violins, guitars, composing locally with each other. So pianos and violins don't go together into pianos, violins, like into a compound. That's not the interpretation. And so this is a novel kind of control in a study that addresses the neural basis of syntax. And so what we found was that a set of perisylvian kind of language regions, in fact, show a larger activity for the items that are inside the sentence. And then we find a different localization of the degree of semantic associativeness between the list members, and that localizes in the temporoparietal junction. So that's my really, really brief summary that will orient you a little bit into the conversation. But let's first find out where our first author, Ryan Law, actually hails from.
Thanks for having me. My name is Ryan, and I was born and raised in Malaysia. And then after that, I moved to London to study linguistics in my undergraduate. And then after that, I got really interested in sort of psycholinguistics and neurolinguistics. And I really wanted to sort of develop a little bit more in terms of my knowledge and skills in the cognitive neuroscience of language. So I moved to Abu Dhabi, and specifically NYU Abu Dhabi, where I worked with you, Lena, and with a bunch of wonderful colleagues. And then now I've just moved to Nijmegen 6 months ago, and where I now work as a lab manager in the language and computation in neurosystems at the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics.
And you're going to enroll in a master's program there as well, or did you already start the master's?
So I've actually started my master's a month ago. As though, you know, moving to a new country in the middle of a pandemic to start a new job wasn't challenging enough. So yeah, simultaneously doing both things.
All right. Very crazy times. Okay, so this paper was kind of our main project, or your main project during the RA ship in our lab in Abu Dhabi. So our lab, the Neuroscience of Language Lab, which I co-direct with my husband and colleague, Alec Marantz, is split between the New York campus and the Abu Dhabi campus. And you were an RA in the Abu Dhabi lab for a couple of years. And so this was sort of our main project for that period of time. And I'm wondering like what your kind of memory is about how the project started. So it's in some sense, it's a very stimulus driven project that it's kind of taking advantage of opportunities afforded by a certain kind of contrast that we can construct with language. But maybe I'm curious to hear how you kind of remember how we started.
Yeah, so it sort of started as kind of us thinking about sort of brainstorming about how we might study the brain bases of syntax. So being sort of one of the few people who had taken way too many syntax courses in the lab during my undergrad, that sort of was like a natural direction to go. And then, so in the literature of sentence processing in general, a typical contrast that people have used is the so-called sentence versus list paradigm. So in this paradigm, researchers typically contrast two very distinct type of stimulus. So on the one hand, you have the sort of fully structured, well-formed sentences that has sort of a fully fledged syntax and a semantic structure as well. And researchers contrast that to the other extreme, which is structureless and sometimes meaningless stimuli. So for example, like a word list where people either scrambled the order of the words in a sentence, or they just take a bag of content words and then just like present to people one by one, that typically. So given this as a backdrop, we take advantage of the fact that word lists can actually also occur inside a sentence. So for example, you might imagine a scenario in which you go to the supermarket and bought apples, pears, bananas, eggs. So in that case, apples, pears, and oranges might not necessarily in themselves be structured, but when embedded inside a sentence, they participate in the syntactic structure of the stimulus. But you could also, of course, have just the stimulus as an unstructured list, right? So for example, in a grocery shopping list, you might just say apples, oranges, pears. So we took advantage of this contrast and sort of put the exact same words that occurred at the same time in a sentence compared to when they occur in a bag of words. And so, yeah, that's where the project started and went into.
Yeah, so I think that, so I was really interested in this contrast because it has been so difficult to identify anything in the brain that seems to reflect the kind of purely structural computations that one in some sense expects to find if you come into the cognitive neuroscience of language as a linguist, which both of us sort of had that entry point. And so, you know, in my lab, I've obviously studied the brain basis of composition for quite a long time. And when I entered that question, one's sort of anticipation was that, you know, composition would have a bunch of neural reflexes, and then maybe some of those reflexes would have a semantic nature and others would have a syntactic nature, and maybe wouldn't be so impossible to kind of carve out that space and understand what each of those correlates of composition might reflect. And in my own work, so what I then sort of found out was that really nothing seemed to have a purely structural nature. Everything seemed to be very semantically sensitive. And so that's why I was curious about this contrast, because here the variables that in previous studies really seem to be the ones that drive the activity, like word meaning and local combinatorics, those are in some sense eliminated. So here, let me just read from your main stimulus table. So we explicitly used bare plurals in the stimulus materials, right? So you would have like the music store sells pianos, violins, guitars, drums and clarinets. And so here what was crucial is that pianos, violins, they don't go together locally. And that kind of going together locally or constructing that local phrase in all of our prior studies, that seemed to be the thing that really matters for the brain. And we've been able to characterize that that kind of local composition really drives the left anterior temporal cortex specifically. And so here, what was interesting is like, okay, let's not let any of that stuff happen. The words stay exactly the same and locally nothing composes, but in one case, there's a full sentential context and in another case, there's just a pure list. But that's not the only manipulation that we had in this design. There's also another factor involved. Can you walk us through the other factor that we kind of crossed with the structure manipulation?
Yeah, of course. So as you mentioned earlier, typically studies of syntax also, you know, are have a semantic sort of nature to the manipulation as well. So in order to properly characterize the brain's responses to syntax, we then thought it would be good to also include a semantic association. So in our study, we looked at the contrast of how much the items in the list associate with one another, but also associating with its broader context. So the example that Lina gave earlier, pianos, violins, guitars, they are sort of, they're part of this category, musical instruments. So that's it's a highly associated context, right? So they happen to be part of that. And so you can give it a sentence context, like the music store sells pianos, violins, guitars, drums, and clarinets. So that would be our high association context. And then we also generated a low association condition. So for example, you might have lamps, dolls, guitars that don't have any sort of strong association among the list items. And so we did this.
The matrix sentence a little bit, but I happen to have the table in front of me. So instead of like the music store sells pianos, violins, guitars, drums, and clarinets, everything coheres very nicely semantically. So then you have to, in order to make the lamps, dolls, guitars also have a natural context. So then you had something like the eccentric man hoarded it, and now you're expecting a random list of things like lamps, dolls, guitars. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Coming up with those stimuli was very, very fun. A lot of fun.
Yeah, so I remember, so the reason that I thought it would be interesting, I mean, one of the many reasons that I thought it would be important to have a manipulation of the association strength was because when you first start to think about these kinds of stimuli naturally, you do think about like the kind of grocery shopping, shopping list type stimuli. And in those cases, the items go together very naturally, even if there's not a syntax that kind of connects them. And so I was really worried that then even in the list stimuli, you would be building up, you would be doing some kind of combinatorics because you're really kind of like building that scene of those musical instruments, maybe in a store or something like that, an orchestra or something like that. And so I was concerned that maybe, you know, we're gonna be looking at some kind of correlates of the structure, but it could be like completely flattened because in both cases you are really kind of building some kind of a coherent representation. And so that's what we kind of tried to eliminate in the case of those low association lists. So there you just have like forks, pen, toilet, rodeo, lamps, dolls, guitars, and so forth. So that was then sort of the question. So can we identify neural correlates of the structural manipulation that, and would they be distinct from the association manipulation? And so what was the answer to that question, Brian? Or maybe before we get to that, let's just say a little bit about the technique. So magnetoencephalography. So why was that a nice technique for this study?
Yeah, so magnetoencephalography allows us to measure brain activity as it changes across time on a millisecond by millisecond resolution. And this is particularly relevant for the processes that we're studying, right? Namely language, and things happen in very fast. So being able to track the activity that may be generated by syntactic and semantic processes, the temporal resolution is really important. And previous work in this sort of sentence versus list tradition has also typically used fMRI, which has a great spatial temporal spatial resolution, but we tend to not see sort of at what point which area of the brain is engaged for a particular task. So yeah, so we decided to use magnetoencephalography to probe this question.
And I think one thing that's also important to just specify is that we did zoom in on those exact three words that we kept constant between the sentences and the list, as opposed to getting kind of like an image of the processing of the whole sentence or something like that.
And that's right.
In addition to that, able to look at position effects, like what position are you occupying in the list? And then obviously zooming down even further, exactly what is the timing of the effect within the response to that individual word. So those are all the opportunities that MEG offers.
And that's also actually allows us to, as Lina alluded at the beginning, which is that it allows us to look at activity elicited by the exact same word in time. So our trick was to position the exact same words from a noun list, both within the sentence and inside a longer list. So further allowing us to sort of kind of minimize the contribution of word semantics in this context.
Mm-hmm. And so then the analysis was a pretty straightforward region of interest or ROI analysis. That was the main analysis. And then you had some complementary whole brain analysis as well. So we defined a certain set of regions of interest, kind of the usual suspects that really tend to be implicated in research on syntax and semantics. So posterior temporal cortex, anterior temporal cortex, left inferior temporal cortex, aka Broca's area, the temporoparietal junction, and then also orbital frontal cortex, which has been implicated for semantic processing in a bunch of prior studies from our lab. And then crucially bilaterally, right? So we looked at both the left hemisphere, which, you know, everyone would kind of expect to maybe find some results in, and the right hemisphere. One thing that I forgot to mention a little bit earlier was that when we embarked in this study, I was very curious about these stimuli, but I actually really thought it would be very likely that there would not be any results. And the reason for that was that all of our prior work really suggested that it's the word meaning, it's the local combinatorics that drive the signal. And now when we took those out of the picture, I thought there was a decently good chance that there wouldn't be anything, like the brain would just be totally quiet. And so now I don't know if you remember in the early days of data collection, I was really wanting to look at those pilot subjects, pilot data with you, because I was like, are these waveforms diverging at all? And so I didn't want you to like embark on something that was like completely not going to yield anything. But then I think pretty immediately we did see that yes, this manipulation would matter for the brain. Because the left anterior temporal cortex, left anterior temporal lobe was a region that, you know, I had seen being very sensitive to the local phrasal combinatorics that were not part of this manipulation, I thought that region would definitely be very, very silent, or I thought that was very likely outcome. But that didn't turn out to be the case. So can you summarize kind of the main findings from the structure manipulation, the sentence list in sentence versus list in list manipulation?
Yeah, definitely. So our main finding is that the sort of language related frontotemporal areas, so the inferior frontal cortex, the anterior temporal lobe and the posterior temporal lobe show an effect for structure. So lists in sentences elicited stronger activity compared to lists in lists. So in other words, the structured conditions drive higher activity compared to unstructured conditions. And then we, given the temporal resolution of MEG, we also are able to look at the different timings that these effects arise in these different regions. So for example, in the inferior frontal cortex, this effect was a little bit earlier compared to the effect in the posterior temporal lobe. So then this sort of qualitative results we tend not to see in imaging modalities that don't have this resolution. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you were to kind of order the effects, then it's the left inferior frontal cortex effect occurs between 200 and 300 milliseconds, and then the left anterior temporal lobe and the posterior temporal lobe effects between 300 and 400 milliseconds. And so that was the surprise for me, is that the left anterior temporal lobe was in fact sensitive to this manipulation. The effect is later than the effects that we see when we do this very local phrase building of the red boat type. So those effects happen pretty consistently around 200 milliseconds to 250 milliseconds. Here, the waveforms actually diverge at that point, but that's just not where your reliable effect is. They come a little bit later. So that's interesting. So basically what we show is that these regions, these three regions, the temporal lobe, both anteriorly and posteriorly, and the left inferior frontal cortex all show an increased signal just by embedding this list in a sentence. What about the association contrast?
Yeah, so the association contrast actually elicited a sort of completely different signature in the brain. So still staying within the left hemisphere, specifically the left temporal parietal junction, this area seems to track associative relationships between the words. So what we found is that in the left temporal parietal cortex, lists that have a higher association elicited higher activity in this region compared to less associative items. So for example, pianos, violins, guitars, in general, just drive the TPJ, that's the temporal parietal junction, a little bit more compared to lamps, dolls, and guitars. So we then see this kind of dissociation between kind of typical structure versus meaning contrast in the brain, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think it is a really kind of surprisingly sharp contrast in this data set. And what makes the temporal parietal junction result, I think, interesting is that it does not look like a priming result in its most canonical form. So kind of everybody would expect semantic relatedness to lessen amplitudes of neural signals. So that's our like very canonical N400 effect, where, you know, especially in the temporal cortex, we usually see a lower activity level for in the presence of semantic relatedness to some context. But here, the signal increased in the TPJ as a function of higher associativeness. So when they're more related, you got this higher signal. And that to me really does suggest that maybe there is something like the type of chunking going on that I worried about. So in that sense, it's sort of satisfying to see that manipulation did have an effect, and it was distinct from the structure manipulation. There is one question that definitely merits further investigation, and we try to be very explicit about it in the paper. And that is that, of course, when you're in that sentential context, not only are you inside a syntactic tree, but there is also a semantic context that, you know, potentially could affect things. And that was kind of a confound that, you know, we decided to leave in for the first study. And, you know, had there not been a pandemic, maybe we would even have a follow-up experiment that started to address that. But I think that maybe that's a chapter for another time. But that is something to be kept in mind, that it's, you know, although it manages to control certain things that are hard to control, like the lexical semantics and the local comment, or it's still not a perfect manipulation. So that's not something that we're trying to suggest. Anyway, congratulations on your, is this your first authored paper?
Yeah, that's right.
That's exciting. And it's really impressive given that, you know, you're not a PhD student even yet. So, that's
thank really you. Thanks very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Really a pleasure to work with you on this project. I'm super happy to see it out.
Likewise, yeah, it was such a great pleasure working with you and many other great colleagues at the Neuroscience of Language Lab at NYU.
I miss you very much. So keep in touch, Ryan.
And that is a wrap from NELAB Spotlight.